Vilima, Coast to Coast, Show 33, September 10th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow and I'm the host of the show. As always, I want to remind everyone there are four ways to contact the show. The first is email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The second is the website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Via voicemail at 206-600-4216. And of course, by the post. At P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065 in the U.S. I also want to remind our listeners that the website has a Frapper map where you can note your location where you listen from. And I think at this point we have pretty much listeners on all the inhabited continents. Don't think we have any listeners in Antarctica, although if you all are out there listening, it would be great to see that listed on the Frapper map. However, it would be wonderful for everybody else who's listening who hasn't put themselves on the Frapper map to do so. Also, the Thelema Coast to Coast website links to the podcast MySpace page. Right now, there are about 840 friends linked to the page, and I know there are more people out there, so feel free to go to the MySpace page. I also post on the blog and on the bulletin when new podcasts come out. So if you subscribe to the blog there, you'll get notice, or if you see the bulletins and so forth. So it's a good way to know when new shows are out if you are a big MySpace user. And of course, I still have the podcast stickers for those who send in a postcard. I'm a little late getting the stickers out from those who I've received postcards from. Don't worry, I still have them. They will be going out soon. It's just I've been swamped lately. But for those who haven't gotten a sticker, all you have to do is send a postcard to the address Thelema Coast to Coast, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065. Just send a cool postcard. It'll get scanned, put up on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, and I'll send you a couple Thelema Coast to Coast bumper stickers. They're first come, first serve, and they go pretty quickly. Got a small stack left, so get your postcard in. I don't have a lot of time for listener feedback because this is a long show, but please keep the feedback coming. I really appreciate it. I love getting the emails, the notices from the website, and I especially love getting voicemail at 206-600-4216. It's great to hear from you listeners, and I want to get feedback on the content of the show. Let me know how it is, if you like it, dislike it, if you disagree, any ideas, suggestions, music, all of those things. It's the suggestions from you all that really kind of keep the podcast going. I do have a few notices real quick, though. First, Stephen Ash has made his recording of Liber All available for free to download. I'll put the URL in the show notes. Also, the song in the last podcast I incorrectly labeled as coming from the artist Sobek. That was corrected. He said the song was not from him. I guess he did the mixing, but the actual song itself, Approach to the New World, was done by a band called Length of Time. So I apologize about that error. And speaking of kind of combining music and Crowley and stuff, sometime last year when I was playing around with recording software and kind of learning my way around so I could do the podcast better, I was playing around with Crowley's Enochian calls and putting some background music and stuff, and I did a mashup of Crowley saying the second Enochian call and threw in some Stevie Wonder with it. I have that up on my blog page at www.thelema.new. That's .nu, if you're interested in downloading that. All right, so today's program is a lecture I gave at Dove and Serpent Oasis in conjunction with Hagia Sophia Chapter. This was given on July 14th, 2006. Keeping in the style of an academic conference, I read my paper and then we discussed it. So the first 20 minutes are me actually going through and just reading the paper straight through, and then the additional 40 minutes are my discussion about the content and about the ideas and so forth that were in the paper with the participants and the audience and so forth. The topics are mostly about Thelemic philosophy, ontology, Crowley's ideas about the Book of the Law, consciousness, discussions of Buddhism and Thelema, where they overlap, where there's differences, and then all the kind of things that influenced Crowley and his metaphysical and philosophical basis. So it's kind of a different discussion instead of the nuts and bolts of ceremonial magic, but it is an area that is absolutely necessary. So here's my talk. It's called The Nature of Becoming, an Examination of Aleister Crowley's Ontology and Map of Consciousness. Okay, the paper is called The Nature of Becoming, an Examination of Aleister Crowley's Ontology and Map of Consciousness. In 1902, English mountaineer, poet, and occultist Aleister Crowley published his Theory of the Universe, in which he combined the concepts of Buddhist ontology with Hermetic Kabbalah regarding the symbolic representation of existence. The central thesis of this work is the enigmatic equation 0 equals 2. He then took his Kabbalistic ontological map and constructed a spiritual practice for the systematic attainment of various levels of consciousness that ended up leading the practitioner to a level of consciousness whereby one is, quote, wholly free of all limitations soever, existing in nature of all things without discrimination of quantity or quality, close quote. In this paper, I plan to explore the meaning of Crowley's 0 equals 2 equation and detail its significance in the context of Buddhism and Western Hermetic Kabbalah. Before examining Crowley's ontology, it is necessary to have a little background information about him. In his adolescence, Crowley rebelled against the spirituality of his parents and began looking to meet his spiritual needs elsewhere. The first significant place Crowley looked was an obscure semi-Masonic organization called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Taking initiation on November 18th, 1898, Crowley advanced quickly. It was within the Golden Dawn that Crowley was exposed to many occult doctrines, including the Hermetic Kabbalah. Also in the Golden Dawn, Crowley met Alan Bennett, who had joined in 1894, where he became an important member. Bennett was a sickly person suffering from asthma. As time progressed, Bennett's illness worsened, and it became so severe he eventually left Britain in 1900 and went to Sri Lanka for a warmer climate. In Sri Lanka, he became a Buddhist monk and adopted the Dharma name Ananda Mateya. A year later, Crowley joined him and converted to Buddhism. It was within this environment that Crowley combined his understanding of the Hermetic Kabbalah attained while a member of the Golden Dawn and his understanding of Buddhist ontology attained while studying with Ananda Mateya to create his theory of the universe, 0 equals 2. One of the core teachings within Buddhism is that the true fundamental state of the universe is void or empty, sunyata. In order to avoid confusion, it should be mentioned here that there are two kinds of truth, conventional truth, samvritti satya, and ultimate truth, paramatha satya. My Sanskrit's not the best, I hope you'll forgive me on that. This means that while in a conventional sense things seem real, in an ultimate sense, nothing has any intrinsic existence or essence, but instead depends on conditions to seemingly cause it to exist. However, even these conditions are illusory. As Buddhist scholar Jay Garfield writes, without individual essences, there will be no basis on which to draw the absolute essential distinctions necessary to establish phenomena as intrinsically other than their conditions. Without substantial differences, there are no absolute others by means to which to characterize phenomena. The cycle of conditioning is called dependent origination, pratityasamutpada, and is the underlying basis of sunyata, or emptiness. In contrast to the ultimate truth, we see around us a conventional truth that seems dualist,
whether the duality is expressed in ideological polemics such as good and evil, or as phenomena that appears to be independent and separate. Conventional truth operates in an apparent state of individuality. Buddhism teaches that this apparent distinction is an illusion, and even emptiness itself is empty and considered dependently arisen. One fundamental aspect important to understand is that when discussing ultimate and conventional truths, both are valid and accurate from a certain point of view simultaneously. When we use expressions in our daily life such as I, or being, or individual, etc., we do not lie because there is no self or being as such, but we speak a truth conforming to convention of the world. But the ultimate truth is that there is no I, or being, in reality. This ultimate lack of duality results in an ontology that is immanent, while conventionally our world appears to be dual. This differentiation between ultimate truth or reality and conventional truth, and both being simultaneously valid, is the key to understanding Crowley's 0 = 2 equation. When discussing the ultimate truth, Crowley uses the word nothing instead of emptiness or void. He equates this nothingness to the zero in his equation. What is imperative to keep in mind is that when Crowley says nothing or zero, he does not mean the absence of something equating to a vacuum or space. Instead, Crowley asserts nothingness is that about which no positive proposition is valid. Like above, where emptiness is itself empty, nothing can be said about Crowley's nothing. In the same way, when he writes zero, he notes it is not the zero of mathematics that is a numerical placeholder that can be written to the first power asserting identity. On the contrary, Crowley's zero is actually zero to the zero power, meaning that it has no identity nor is existed in any categories. On the other side of the equation, we find the number two. The two is representative of duality. Crowley notes that it could be written also as 1 + -1. This is because for something to exist in a conventional sense, it must be contrasted against an environment or background dissimilar to the thing itself. As a simple illustration, Crowley wrote, "All that of which we are aware must obviously possess limits, or it could have no intelligible meaning to us. If we want pork, we must specify its qualities and quantities. At the very least, we must be able to distinguish it from that which is not pork. All the phenomena that surrounds us can be observed because we differentiate it against something that is not the same. It is this mental differentiation that creates the illusion of duality. Finally, in the middle of the equation is the equal sign. This indicates that there is no difference between the ultimate truth represented by the zero and conventional truth represented by the two." Quoting from the Vimalakita Nirdesa Sutra, Garfield notes that the distinction between conventional and ultimate is itself dualistic, and hence merely conventional. To realize it is to enter into non-dual awareness. The non-dual understanding of existence is vitally important to understanding Thelema and Liber All Veligis. The cosmological concepts of Nui and Hari are contained in the equation 0 = 2. For instance, the following is Crowley's commentary on the Liber All verse, "Be thou Hari, my secret center, my heart and my tongue." Crowley writes, "Nui formulates me as Hari, especially in the three centers of consciousness of her being. For this purpose, I became the complement of her." These centers are those of love, life, and language. Duality is the condition of all three. It will appear later how that it is that none and two are identical. They are distinct in our minds only because those minds are conscious and therefore think of two as their own state. But the unconscious mind thinks nothing and is nothing, yet it is the same. Nui selects the three centers of her body to become two with Harit, for she asked me to declare her in these three: infinite freedom, all-embracing, for physical love, boundless continuity of life, and the silent rhythm of the stars of language. These three concepts are her gift to us. As can be seen, the duality between Nui and Harit are conventional, as are the very states of consciousness that Crowley discusses. Nevertheless, since we are conscious, being human, We need to work within these limits until we obtain a level of understanding whereby we can get beyond duality and understand existence in its ultimate form, non-dual. This is the goal of Crowley's system, and since he was exposed to the Golden Dawn framework, he used it when creating his system. When formulating the equation of 0 equals 2, Crowley used the Hermetic Kabbalah's Tree of Life, the diagram that you have in front of you, the Tree of Life diagram, to map out the process of consciousness attainment. Within the Golden Dawn, the Kabbalah and the Kabbalistic Tree of Life were of great importance. Each grade or level of advancement was attributed to a sephiroth or a sphere on the tree. In addition, noted occult author Israel Regardi stated that the Tree of Life has been found to be the most convenient system yet discovered of classifying phenomena in the universe and recording their relations. The Golden Dawn used the Tree of Life to map out its initiatory system. Crowley used the Tree of Life, much like the Golden Dawn did, to map out the stages of one's attainment and to articulate the steps each person would observe when reaching each stage. The tree itself is made of 10 circles or sphere arranged in 3 columns and connected with 22 paths. The top 3 spheres and paths form an upward pointing triangle. The next 2 sets of 3 spheres form 2 downward pointing triangles, and at the bottom center is the 10th sphere. In addition to the paths forming the triangles, there are other paths connecting various spheres together in a system that is mirrored on both sides of the center column. The spheres are numbered 1 through 10, starting at the top center and ending at the bottom center. In addition to the spheres and paths, there are also 3 ovals that surround the tree and are called the veils of existence. This is the diagram and classification system that Crowley used to map out his levels of consciousness. Crowley first placed the 0 of 0 equals 2 at the top of the diagram, represented by the 3rd veil of existence called Ein, to which he states, "I assert the absoluteness of the Kabbalistic zero." Ein means nothing in Hebrew, and is what Crowley equated to sunyata. The other side of the equation is located in Malkuth, the 10th sphere of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, in which conventional dualistic existence operates. The 22 connecting paths represent symbolic gateways or connections. Because of the immense scope of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, I'm going to concentrate on the center column and in particular focus on the 3 spheres, Malkuth, Tiphereth, and Kether. Conceptually, Malkuth is where one operates in a day-to-day sense and thus experiences the illusion of duality. All phenomena appear real and separate. This is also the place where time and space are perceived. To this end, Crowley asserted, time was necessarily created by us in order to make room for the apparent existence of the duality to which we devise. 2 phenomena which occur in time would be considered simultaneous if separated in space, so that our observations of the former were delayed. So as far as we are concerned, i.e. in our sensoria, so that any 2 impressions can only be registered by us as consecutive. Even when we are aware of their simultaneity, we are compelled to place them in sequence. Because of the illusion of duality, our conventional consciousness makes the distinctions between one object or thought versus another in time and space. As such, we constantly differentiate and order our surroundings based on observations of separateness and when we observe phenomena. The result is we invent space, time, sense impressions, etc., to enable us to distinguish between experiences, to express our conception of the multiplicity of the possibilities contained in the idea of zero. Similarly, discussing the illusory principle of the independence of separate phenomena, Garfield points out that the arising and cessation of phenomena appear simultaneous and distinct only because we misunderstand the nature of dependent arising and thus confuse conventional reality to be ultimate reality. However, Crowley states that there are further states of consciousness in which eventually this illusion is eliminated. The next state of consciousness proceeds from an observation of duality to a state of unity or one-pointed consciousness. This state of mind is mapped to the Kabbalistic sphere of Tiphereth. You'll find that in the center of your diagram. In Tiphereth, Crowley notes the vision or apprehension, a much better word, of the universe is as a single phenomenon, outside all limitations, whether of time, space, causality, or whatnot. It is in this state of consciousness that one obtains knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. Knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel was Crowley's term for uniting the conscious mind with the subconscious when one achieves one-pointed consciousness and the differentiation between any one thing and any other is removed. This includes the perception of time, space, perceptions of cause and effect, even the distinction between the conscious and the subconscious mind. In his ceremony to lead the practitioner towards one-pointed consciousness called Liber Samech, Crowley wrote, "The angel appeareth in Tipperah, which is the heart of the Ruach, and thus the center of gravity of the mind. Hence, the angel is the truth, the logos, or articulate expression of the whole being of the adept, so that as he increases in the perfect understanding of his name, he approaches the solution of the ultimate problem, who he himself truly is." The subconscious, Crowley said, was, to all intents and purposes, the holy guardian angel, with whom the aspirant wished to communicate, in order to establish his or her true will. Crowley stated that one obtains one's true will when one becomes fully aware of one's true self and gains complete self-knowledge. This self-knowledge is obtained by withdrawing for a time to a monastic form of self-consciousness, which does not distinguish between the ego and non-ego, in other words, obtaining samadhi. One concludes from this that the universe is identical with the ego, and all things dissolve into a formless essence characterized by knowledge and bliss. But this early stage of samadhi is an illusion. But subsequent samadhis teaches that his universal instantaneous unity exists as none and two, and he learns that his samadhi is particular to himself as well as common to all. When this state of consciousness is reached, barriers between the conscious mind and the subconscious are eliminated, and they interact as one. This is the main task of the practitioner, was to have knowledge and conversation with his holy guardian angel, to become aware of his nature and purpose, fulfilling them. Reaching this point of self-knowledge, i.e. knowing one's true will, was of great significance to Crowley. In fact, it was the centerpiece of his spiritual and philosophical system. Despite the importance of this step in the path of attainment, this state of consciousness is only a step on the path towards deeper states of consciousness, a state in which the true nature of existence is revealed. Crowley places this level of attainment on the Kabbalistic sphere called Kether. You'll see that on the top of your diagram. Kether is where one becomes fully aware of the ultimate nature of truth, what Buddhists often call enlightenment. Crowley called this ultimate state of consciousness or initiation ipsissimus, a combination of the Latin word ipse, meaning self, and the Latin superlative inflection issimus. In regard to this attainment, Crowley writes, "The ipsissimus is wholly free from all limitations soever, existing in the nature of all things without discrimination of quantity or quality between them. He has identified being and not being and becoming, action and non-action, and tendency to action, with all other triplicities, not distinguishing between them in respect to any conditions or between any one thing and any other thing as to whether or it is with or without conditions. The ipsissimus is preeminently the master of all modes of existence. That is, his being is entirely free from internal or external necessity. His work is to destroy all tendencies to construct or to cancel such necessities. He is the master of the law of unsubstantiality, anatta. The ipsissimus has no relation as such with any being. He has no will in any direction, no consciousness of any kind involving duality. The ipsissimus no longer operates on a day-to-day basis within the illusion of duality. Upon reaching a fundamental understanding of the truth, one continues to operate in a world around us, but sees and understands phenomena in a radically different way." Commenting on this state of consciousness, Crowley describes it as the experience where the universe itself is abolished and not annihilated. He continues, "It is commonplace to say that there are no words to describe this final destruction. Such is the fact, and there is nothing one can do about it but put it down boldly, as I have done above." As can be seen, Crowley obtained much of his ontological understanding from the concepts of Buddhism, translating his ideas of sunyata, or emptiness, into the Kabbalistic Ein, or nothing. Crowley adapted the concepts of dependent origination, pratityasamutpada, and conventional truth, samvritti satya, and ultimate truth, paramattha satya, into the compact equation 0 equals 2. In doing so, he took Eastern ontological concepts and presented them in a Western Kabbalistic framework, that can be explored by those with little Eastern understanding. By mapping the various states of consciousness to the spheres of the Kabbalistic tree of life, Crowley presents a system by which a practitioner could systematically work to gain the various forms of consciousness. By transcending dual consciousness and leaving Malkuth, a practitioner can reach one-pointed consciousness and achieve the first major goal of obtaining knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, and gaining one's understanding of one's true will, this stage being mapped to Tipperith. No small task in itself, but once completed, the practitioner would work towards higher states of consciousness, ending in the sphere of Kether, obtaining comprehension of the true nature of the universe. Taken altogether, Crowley's system of attainment combined disparate elements of Eastern and Western philosophy and theology into a spiritual philosophy by which practitioners can obtain higher states of consciousness and understanding of themselves and the universe. All right, that's the paper. So, I saw a whole bunch of glazed looks on people's faces, and rightly so. It's oriented towards an academic audience. So let's start going back and looking at the two realities of truth. Okay, so first of all, we start off looking at the core teaching in Buddhism is that the universe itself is empty, sunyata. Okay, what this means is that nothing is intrinsic of itself. You're seeing me standing here and you think I exist, but ultimately I'm not really here. I'm just a combination of a bunch of processes and conditions that have come together at this moment to put this form together. And based on other processes and conditions, this form will change. So as I take breaths, as I learn new things, the John that you see standing here, it will not be the John of tomorrow. And all of us are constantly changing. So this is what dependent origination is. Nothing is intrinsically itself anywhere. And what that means is that the differentiation that we make, you know, of the podium here and the speakers there, and it's really just an illusion that our mind has by looking at the things called edges. I stand here because you can tell I'm here, and the curtains are behind me. If you couldn't see anything beyond me, you couldn't see my edges, you couldn't see me. Because I'm only understandable when I'm differentiated from something else. And this is where the two truths is coming together. Ultimately, nothing has any intrinsic separate existence, sunyata or ein, nothingness. But conventionally, in the world around us, we see things separate all the time. You know, each person sitting here in these chairs, or me standing up here, or the food that we're going to enjoy later, it all seems very separate to us. Because we make distinctions here and there. And so this cycle of conditions coming together is called pratityasamutpada, or dependent origination. Now, what's really difficult to understand about that is when someone says there's no I, and this is a core tenet of Buddhism, which I should note that later Crowley rejected. Crowley does believe that there is ultimately something that is transpersonal, that is reincarnated, whereas Buddhism asserts a no-self, anatta, that has a tendency to be reborn, but there's no actually self, there's no eternal soul or anything like that that is reborn. Buddhism also makes a distinction between reincarnation and rebirth. And within Buddhism, rebirth is this tendency, it's like going from, like if you had a row of candles, picking up the first candle that's and lighting the second candle, blowing out the first one, putting it down, taking the second candle, right, lighting the third, doing that all the way down to the end. You'd have a whole bunch of candles that were lit and were blown out, and you'd have this final candle burning. That flame seems to have a continuity through all of the candles, but it's not the same flame. And so Buddhism makes that distinction that there is a continuity there, but it's not the same self. Whereas within Crowley's system, there is a reincarnating self. So this is something that Buddhism asserts that ultimately is different from Crowley's ontological understanding. Now, Crowley would still say that self ultimately is nothing, but has a transpersonal reincarnation existence that is more permanent than, say, everything else that we can see. So we have this nothing that is the top sphere of the tree of life there. And then you have the conventional duality where we're seeing all of these edges and making the differentiations in Malkuth. The stages that he's talking about is working with the working up towards those levels of consciousness. Let me stop at this point before getting to Tiphereth and see if there are any questions about what I've said so far. So is everybody following this, or is this just not making any sense? Go ahead, Richard.
Well, there's a kind of a median thing between the idea that we all have an essence that actually reincarnates, and Crowley's idea that we do have an I. This is like very... there's a current through this some of the Sufi mystical schools where it's not like the Christian idea where you're born with a soul that's eternal, but that you have the capacity because of the creature you are to synthesize and concretize a soul that can outlast your death.
No. Well, okay, yeah, let's talk about that.
With the like attainment of the rainbow bodies, where you are truly reincarnated with the existing energy from the prior life.
Well, there's going to be a lot of different theories on reincarnation and a lot of conceptions of soul. There's actually some ideas within Buddhism where you have different levels of consciousness within a Buddhist idea called Yogacara. There are 7 levels of consciousness, and there's the 7th level, the Alaya consciousness, which has more permanency and is recarded. And then you're going to find all kinds of other Neoplatonic and just other kinds of systems. What we want to concentrate here is not kind of pull all of those in. What we're doing is kind of comparing and contrasting the basic Buddhist ideas of ontology and existence, or anatta, and Crowley's, starting with Buddhism. And then over time, what he kept from Buddhism and what he changed. So I certainly understand you that there are going to be a myriad of systems out there that have a lot of different conceptions of the self and the soul. But we could spend all night just talking about all of those different conceptions. And so what we want to do is kind of focus on these two to compare and contrast them. So what I want to make sure is that people understand where Buddhism's coming from, at least kind of an inkling of that. Shannon?
Those basic beliefs. I don't have any.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of a big thing, but to sum it up, Buddhists do not believe in any god. They don't believe in any supernatural higher being. They don't believe in any soul. They don't believe in anything. It has a permanency. They do believe in this cycle of rebirth, and they have these 6 realms that you can be reborn in, and one of the realms is humanity. The other realms are like the Deva realm, which is translated the God realm, and then the Sura, which is the fighting gods or the wrathful gods. Then you have the realm of the hungry ghosts, and then hell. And then the realm of animals. So the realm of the animals, the hungry ghosts, and the hell realm are considered the 3 negative realms of rebirth. And then the human, the deva, and the asura, the fighting deities or the demigods, are considered the positive realms of rebirth. The most positive, though, is considered the human realm, because we have consciousness within that realm and the ability to transcend and reach nirvana. The way that the Buddhists see it is the cycle of karma and samsara, you're stuck on this wheel because of karma. And it doesn't matter if because of your karma you're going up the wheel or you're coming down. If you're going up the wheel, you may be in chains of gold, and if you're coming down, you're in chains of iron. But the reality is you're still in chains. So the whole goal is to break those chains, to break the cycle of rebirth, and at death, instead of having all of these attachments and tendencies due to karma to cause you to be reborn in one of the realms, to have those attachments broke so that karma just ceases and you attain nirvana, which is extinguishness.
And you can choose, because if you've taken the vow of the
Bodhisattva... Technically, no. Not within traditional Buddhism. You have no choice.
Really?
There is no you to choose.
Right.
What happens is that your attachments choose for you, the things that you're grasping for. Usually the things that you're grasping for closest at death are the most powerful within your karma, and that's what will cause. Yeah.
You presented Crowley's work in placing Buddhist ontology on the Tree of Life as a sort of artifice. In this lecture, at least, it wasn't an act of prophecy where they happened to all meet on some higher plane. Well, you said inspire. You said this Buddhist principle inspired Hadita Nui.
Yes.
And, you know, so
well, I shouldn't say inspire. I'm saying Crowley connected those two in his explanation.
Okay, so, well, that's, I guess I can only argue on what, the content of the lecture, which you said was delivered in a very different context, did use this, the idea that it was an inspiration, that it was an act of artifice. And so to only argue and question what is in the lecture, why would, within that frame, it be useful to attach these concepts to this schema? To whom does this make Buddhism clearer?
Actually, Crowley's not trying to make Buddhism clearer. He's trying to take these ideas and give them in a Western context to Westerners. For instance, I just concentrated on three spheres, and this is ultimately his spiritual system is the AA system. So if you start looking at the other spheres, like on Yasad is the Zelator initiation. So you would have a mirroring work of doing magical and yoga work. So for instance, on the yoga work, you'd be working on your asana and pranayama. And on the additional spheres, on the way to Tiprith, you would be working for dhyana and different types of practices to get you to the point where you can reach one-pointed consciousness. So what he did was he took the Tree of Life based on his Golden Dawn, and he mapped out a similar system of the individual stages. You're not going to get to levels of single-pointed consciousness if you can't sit still, if you can't control your breathing, if you can't control your mind. So he's got all of those initiations. Now, in conjunction with those, he also has magical practices within each one. So he doesn't see them as contradictory. He sees magic and yoga as two halves of the same thing. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
Okay. Dan?
Something that I read, I can't remember where I read it, but he said that both were important because one did inner work and the other did outer work.
Yes.
So it was in itself, he balanced those out.
Right. I also want to, in this question and answer part, I want to make a distinction between Buddhist kind of yoga work and Hindu kind of yoga work. They actually have very different goals. Within Hindu yoga work, You're trying to get to single points of concentration. And this is closer to what Crowley's working is doing for the samadhi. Within Buddhist concentration, you're not trying to get to being able to concentrate singularly on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. You're trying to get to a point where you are completely and utterly present in what you're doing. And that you know, in Zen they call it zazen, where you're completely and utterly present. So that's kind of a big difference that they're going for. He learned his first yoga techniques from Oscar Eckenstein. Am I saying that correctly? I think so. So he learned those from him, then later studied with Bennett, and he ended up furthering his yogic practice, but ultimately for the techniques that he's trying to do within the AA system, he's closer to Eckenstein. And you can see that if you read his eight lectures on yoga, he concentrates on a lot of the Hindu type practices. Okay, any other questions so far? Okay, so let's go and take a look at this conventional duality. So Crowley's saying this two, not one, and he's very clear about that. There's no such thing as unity, because you can't have one. You can only have nothing, or you can have two. Because if you have one, you need something to differentiate that one. And if you have edges to differentiate it, now you have two. One and not one. So, yes?
Which very much mirrors the whole idea of quantum physics.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Quantum physics very much resonates with Buddhism and Taoism and and a lot of these ideas, absolutely. So what's really important to understand here is you'll see a lot in the writings, especially of Akkad, where he talks about above the abyss understanding is a combination of self and selflessness and things like that. You know, if you have good, you're going to have evil. And so you get these polemics. But duality is also the differentiation of any one thing as another. And so we can start seeing that kind of discussion going on in Crowley's commentaries when you're looking at something like the verse of Nuit saying, you know, make no distinctions between one thing or another, thereby it becomes hurt. This is how Crowley's interpreting that kind of statement, as in, ultimately, if you accept duality, you're going to be operating on a false premise and cause a lot of problems. Okay, so that's why he gets in that, you know, within duality we specify, and he used the example of pork. So, you know, pork is, you know, sitting here on a plate in front of you. Well, I'm not going to eat the plate, so the plate is obviously not pork, and now I'm differentiating, that kind of thing. So does that make sense so far? Okay. So these ideas are really important, because if you go and look at his commentaries to Liber All, or if you read Liber Aleph or Magic, he permeates these ideas in everything. And if you don't understand where he's coming from, even if you disagree with all of this, that's fine. But you need to understand this is the kind of stuff that he's talking about. And so I gave an example of that one thing. But this is the Magical and Philosophical Commentaries of the Book of the Law, a great book. I highly recommend it. But you can just go to any number of verses. This one is for then the priest answered and said unto the queen of space, kissing her lovely brows, etc., etc. He says, physical description at the onset of ecstasy refers to the actual facts at the period of receiving the knowledge. The attempt to resolve all into one is a philosophical blunder. It explains nothing, neither how one came to be, nor how two came to be. The only sound conception is that of zero, not extended, with a phrase of something, zero to the zero equals x, which answers both questions self-evident. The idea one is intelligible enough as a result of the resolution of two, but in itself it is meaningless because of the absence of any coordinates. So, or you could jump through here, and he talks about samadhi in this place, or here's something in chapter two where he's like, he is not extended, that is, without condition of any sort in the metaphysical sense. Only in the highest trances can the nature of these truths be realized. It is indeed a super-rational experience, not dissimilar to those characteristics of the star sponge vision. And he just goes down, and he's talking about how Nui and Hadi are these two that are ultimately in the nothing. So if you just go through all the commentaries, I mean, it's referred to dozens and dozens of times, and it's why it's a really important thing. The other thing is, a lot of people question whether or not it is still Crowley's ideas, because he wrote Bereshith, which is his essay on ontology, in 1902, when he was still a Buddhist. Notice it's 2 years before the reception of the Book of the Law, and many, many years before he really started working with the Book of the Law. But he writes in these commentaries in, let's see, what's the date on this one? This is written in around 1920. This passage, referring to Bereshith, was written in 1902 EV, before the revelation of the law. It remains true that infinite space is the contradiction in terms, and so on. But this is no argument against the cosmology of the book. For above the abyss, every idea soever is necessarily a contradiction in terms. See Liber 418, which is the vision and the voice. For the demonstration of this, there is much more of these points in Liber Aleph and the Urn. He also, in his Magic Without Tears, which was written before a few years before he died in the mid-1940s, he also has an essay in there about zero equals two, and again, he asserts Bereshith. So for 20 or 40-some years, he accepted this ultimate ontology for Thelema, and used it as the basis of his understanding of everything within Thelema. So it's why it's a very important thing, if we're going to be studying Thelema, to get these philosophical things. And that's another point that I want to make to you all. A lot of people study Crowley and Crowley's work in a ceremonial sense, and that's good. But that's not all that's out there. Crowley was very, very philosophical in how he approached a lot of this material. And to understand this material, we really have to study the same philosophical things that he's done. And this is something that I see Thelemites not really approaching, which is kind of why I wanted to do this lecture. So I really encourage you all to take the time and do some basic reading. Crowley was hugely influenced by Nietzsche, Hegel, and many other philosophers, Kant, and so forth. So I really encourage you to take the time and read a lot about philosophy, because if you don't, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is not going to make sense. Okay, so let's get to the Kabbalistic map. Was that pretty straightforward? Basically, you have the duality on Malkuth and things like that. Now, I know earlier in this I was talking about the Holy Guardian Angel. In magic, Crowley says that only an idiot would build a system based on the ideas of the Holy Guardian Angel, and that he just took the term and kind of made it up, or actually took it from the Abramelin working, but it really meant nothing. And so what did he do? As an idiot, he turned around and built a system on it. So then in Alistair Explains Everything, which was his original title for Magic Without Tears, yeah, that's what he was going to call it. He says that the Holy Guardian Angel is a separate being altogether. The confusing thing, and the thing that a lot of people point to, is that in Magic Without Tears, Crowley says that the Holy Guardian Angel is a separate being. And actually, within the commentaries, he refers to the Holy Guardian Angel as being part of the self and as a separate being. At one point, he says in here, for every step you take towards your Holy Guardian Angel, he takes two towards you. So it seems very confusing that at one sense, he's talking about the Holy Guardian Angel as a separate person, and at the other sense, that the Holy Guardian Angel is part of the self, or maybe the self-conscious, or a subconscious. Well, what are we doing when we kind of make those distinctions? Yeah, we're being very dualistic. And ultimately, if you were in a non-dual frame of mind, there would actually be no distinction between the Holy Guardian Angel as part of the self and the Holy Guardian Angel as separate from the self. John?
Wouldn't the whole purpose of working a system like this be to experience dualism as much as you can in order to transcend it? Because transcending dualism prior to a thorough understanding of it will only lead to madness, I think. A sudden understanding of everything that the universe is by somebody who has no intent on doing that
you don't go from Malkuth to Kether,
right,
by a blink of the eye.
Right.
It's a staged process.
And part of that process is to thoroughly explore your aspect of dualism, the dualism where you are, so that
you're going to explore dualism just by getting up in the morning. So,
but that can be argued that if all you're doing is getting up in the morning, that you're not really exploring it, or you're only half-heartedly.
If you look at the way Crowley's program is going, yes, in the early stages, you're dealing with understanding the illusion of dualism. But there's no reveling in the dualism, because you're ultimately reveling in an illusion.
Well, I don't mean reveling. In fact, reveling in it would almost be
contrary to what you want to do.
Rejecting it and being just part of the world and existing in it.
Right. So ultimately, your goal is to see duality for what it is, and maybe that's your point.
Yeah.
But it's to understand it at a fundamental level, and that's the really important thing. We all may leave here today, and we all may accept, oh, yes, you know, the world is non-dual, and that's the way it is, and we all just see duality as conventional. I'm an Ipsissimus, right? No. The what you're trying to get to is a fundamental understanding of these things at the deepest core of your being, that you, when you experience everything, when you look at everything, when you think about everything, you think about it in a non-dual way.
And the Buddhists talk about this. Earlier, I was quoting Crowley when he was saying, what was it? It's like an annihilation. And once it happens, it happens, and there's nothing you can do about it, and there's no way to describe it. The Buddhists say it's like blowing out a flame. Once the flame is blown out, it doesn't come back. Once the duality of your core perception is gone, it's gone, and it doesn't come back. And it, you know, there's millions of people over time who have tried to get to that point, and very few do. So it's not an easy thing to get.
In the description of that system earlier, there was no denial of duality.
Oh, actually there was.
No, there was no denial of duality. There was the making no difference between one thing or another, not necessarily not recognizing that one thing is one thing. But that you neither construct nor block obsessively.
That's correct. But what you're missing is the fact that when the Ipsissimus has no relation with any being, he has no will in any direction or no consciousness of any kind involving duality. His consciousness has ceased to work on the premises that are dual binding, such as distance, time. These things don't exist. They are conventions that the mind makes to differentiate things. For instance, if there is no time, we wouldn't know when to start and when to stop.
Does that necessarily mean that you are, while having a consciousness that includes all things, you do not have the consciousness of this mind that conceives of duality?
The way that it has been explained, because I certainly don't claim to be in this state myself, the way it has been explained is that you understand everything that's around you, and you still pick up a glass and drink, you know, when you're hungry, you eat, but your underlying consciousness and way of understanding existence around you is not based on dualism distinctions. Some of this is really hard to explain, simply as, you know, no words can describe this final destruction. It, you know, it's certain levels of understanding that I myself can only quote the people who claim to have gotten it, because I'm not there.
To attain that state and yet have theoretical connection with a creature that's living here, then you pretty much have to train that creature really well in its automatic behaviors so that it doesn't, like, die while you're not allowing it to be aware that it needs to be.
No, you're completely misunderstanding this. There's no rejection of the world around you. There's no, you know, denial of, you know, that if there's a dog right there, that there's a dog right there. It's a fundamental understanding that the distinctions that you're making between you and the dog, and, you know, the ground that it's on and the air that we breathe, is a form of convention, and you see it in a very different way. Dan?
Are you saying then that the Sisyphus views the world around him and doesn't see himself as separate from the world, or any other parts separate? He realizes their individual components. I guess my big question, does an Ipsissimus know he's an Ipsissimus?
Well, that's a good question.
As one that is a uniter or dual.
Right. Crowley at one point did claim to be an Ipsissimus, and so did Akkad. So does an Ipsissimus claim their Ipsissimus? Well, if you accept that Crowley was one and or Akkad was one, I don't know. That's something that an individual would have to judge for themselves, and others who interact with that person would have to judge too.
The reason I ask that is in Lever Newton, in the exercise, one of the first things he says is that the magician should seek to stop making a choice or discriminate between things.
Mm-hmm.
Simply. Yeah.
Right.
Which gets tricky because the choice of comparing things is a very subtle thing. And if you think you're not doing it, you're doing it.
Yes.
No, and I would venture to guess a smart person who is an obsessiveness would not go around claiming their obsessiveness.
It sounds to me like the state of being an obsessiveness is very similar to the attainment of Mahamudra Yoga from Kashmir Shaivites, which is very close. It's a Hindu form that's very close to Tibetan Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And Mahamudra is the great seal of yoga, which is the exact state you've been describing, which is the state of simultaneously being aware that your body is discrete from other things,
okay,
but at the same time is completely in union, so that every single waking moment you're simultaneously aware of the dual and non-dual nature of the universe. And by being
I'm not familiar with that system, so I can't answer to that.
It sounds very similar. I've been studying a yoga called Yoga Spindaparita lately, and it seems very, very similar. Of course, nowhere near even thinking, but just...
Right.
But it seems very similar to that. It's Mahamudra Yoga is the yoga that's transcendental of the eight limbs of yoga, or the great seal, which is where where you have obtained that state. And it seems to me from your expression of what the system is supposed to be, that, mm-hmm, that would be the state of having obtained the sacred tremor is how it's called, where you're understanding, where you're able to move within the vibrational field is simultaneously dual and non-dual.
Mm, okay. Alan?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. You mentioned something in passing that I think probably is very important. You said there would be certain things that one would sort of expect if one were in the presence of an obsessiveness claimed or otherwise. As you're aware, I have a little list of people for the last 200 years that I would consider to be in that category.
Right. And so did Crowley. His list was a little different than yours.
Yeah. But
there were definitely overlaps.
A considerable number of overlaps. Do you think that there would be something in the way of, I'm loath to use the term objective, scientific testing, whereby one would at least be able to assess that something seems to be in the direction that is attributed to existence, similar to, at a lesser level, some of the testing that has been done with Buddhist monks in Japan, for example, showing objective changes in brain waves during meditation and so forth? Or is it something...
I don't know. And that ultimately is the answer. I don't know. But... It would seem to me that consciousness cannot be measured, and that ultimately is the scientific method. Now, even what you're talking about there is where they're hooking up various equipment that can get the brainwave patterns and see heat centers and where blood is flowing within certain brain centers and things like that. And they've done experiments where Buddhist monks in certain somatic states and nuns who are in deep prayer to God, they've looked at their brains, and the brains actually have the same sort of functioning, same areas that have blood, and they describe very similar aspects of feeling oneness with the universe and all of these different things. But then when you turn around and say, well, where did that come from? The nuns will say, well, that's from the grace of God. And the Buddhist monks will say, well, that's because I'm in certain states of conscious meditation. So there are physical aspects to it that are certainly measurable, that science is getting more and more capable of looking at and detecting. But the levels of consciousness, science has not been able to touch. And the closest thing it can do is various psychological practices, and even those end up getting closer to kind of, especially if you go into like cognitive behavioral and things like that, they're more about actions and habits and more of the animal side than the higher levels of consciousness. So would there be a way of testing that in a scientific illuminist way? I do not know.
Wouldn't it be very active trying to quantify it, force it to the dualistic side?
Yes, in some degrees. Jung writes about in the limits of science that science can only measure things that can have quantities and qualities and things that can be repeated. you know, certain states of consciousness or, you know, eternal states of consciousness that are not measurable or detectable by instruments wouldn't necessarily be able to be scientifically verified. However, that doesn't mean that through people's interactions with the individual that they wouldn't be able to do some kind of discerning to understand. And also, I think that there is an underlying axiomatic or presupposition layer of some values and morals that are involved in individuals. Because somebody may have these states of consciousness of non-duality or something like that, but how they're going to express it is very different based on their backgrounds and their morals and values. So let's, you know, for the sake of argument, say that the Buddha and Jesus Christ both attained the exact same state of consciousness. Well, coming from a Jewish background, Jesus explained it in this kind of Neoplatonic separate, you know, God realm or the realm of the forms, you know, that's this perfect realm, and then the realm of matter, which is, you know, flawed and sinful. So he expressed it in those kind of terms, whereas the Buddha, coming from a Hindu background and rejecting the Brahmanic system in the Varna that was there, it expressed it in a very different way. One, you know, Jesus is asserting an immortal soul, which is, you know, a basis within Judaism, and the Buddha is rejecting the soul idea that is foundational within Hinduism. So if they got to the same state and consciousness, all of that, those other things caused them to express their experiences in different ways.
So are you saying, yes, there might be ways that you could at least get an inkling as to...
I think if there is some similarities in values and morals and presuppositions, I think if Jesus went and started preaching in like India back when he lived, and assuming that he lived and preached what they say he preached, he would have gone around saying that I'm the Son of God and, you know, I'm the Messiah, and they would look at him and say, we're all the sons of gods and we're all the Messiahs. So his message would have been received very differently.
Well, they had Krishna.
I'm sorry?
Very similar. Krishna had a very similar message to Jesus, and they just simply incorporated that.
Right. They just kind of looked at him and said, oh, great, another Vishnu. Wonderful. You know, and the Buddhism did not really take off well in India. I mean, it really flourished once it got into China and other places, because in India they just kind of said, well, great, the Buddha's another incarnation of Vishnu. And so, they have this tendency to just kind of like co-op everything, and Hinduism is so pluralistic that, you know, this group of Hindus believe this. I mean, even the term Hinduism is kind of a false description. Yes, Shannon? Yes, he did say a lot of things, but don't misunderstand his use of the word soul, because you're kind of projecting a Judeo-Christian idea of the immortal, eternal soul. Yes, no, he said lots of things about women. But he actually, if you go and read the commentaries, he says a lot of very positive things about women, asserting that their rights as equals, that they should be using their weapons and their capabilities on the forefront with men, that they should be seen as a comrade in the battle against tyranny.
The line said that women didn't have souls because he was studying women like Nuit.
Exactly. If you look at women as Nuit, as in the zero, they don't have the creative principle. Whereas if you look at men as the two, Hadid, they have that creative principle. But they're the same. That's the difference. You know, there may be this conventional difference that we see, but, and then there's also within the Book of the Law where it says that a woman can obtain Hadid. So there's certainly an aspect of that where she can manifest within it. And we also need to remember that Crowley's system is solar phallic. So there is a privileging to the male gender within the system, and that's just a reality of the system.
I'd like to go back a little bit to the whole idea of transcending space and time. All right. What do you think the connection, just to use another system that Crowley incorporated in this, even though it has less to do with the core ideas, but in more of a form that he uses, the Egyptian system that he took the Nuit, Hadid, Rahu, Kuit from Nhorpa Krat, Now, these ideas, he changed them a lot. I understand that. And then he used them really as identifiers. But do you think that connection between the Egyptian idea of the ankh or the sandal strap or the god's power to go might be indicative of their understanding of some type of non-duality, so that once they had that, these are people or Nephilim or whatever they were, who knows, who actually had these understandings, they were able, because they weren't in a state of deep meditation, they could travel basically, because there was no difference between them and anywhere or anything, so they could go anywhere at any time, and they were it was them all at the same time.
I have really nothing that I can say about that. That is an area that I have no experience or have thought anything of. The one thing that I would want to point out a correlation is that, you know, the thing to go would very much correlate to the will,
right,
and action, yeah, and doing. I mean, Crowley is all about, the will is about active,
right,
manifestation and being. And that's why I called the paper the nature of becoming, because it's not a passive, it's a very active, and it's always a state of continuous manifestation and continuous becoming. The will is always manifesting. The will is not a thing that is, it's not a being, it only exists in becoming. And here, let me give you an example. I'm assuming everyone in here breathes, because if you weren't breathing, you wouldn't be here. But what is breath? Can anyone point to it? Can anyone hold it? Okay, everyone breathe in. Hold it. Are you breathing right now? No. Breathe out. Now you're breathing. Breathing is the process. Oops, excuse me. Breathing is the process of breathing in, or inhaling and exhaling. You're not breathing unless you're doing both. So there's really no such thing as breathing. It's just this back and forth of the polemic. So, ultimately, there is nothing that is breathing, but we all do it in a very conventional sense in this polemic. So, breathing isn't happening unless you are actively doing that polemic. Inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. You're manifesting at that moment. If you stop and hold your breath, or if you breathe out and don't breathe in, you're no longer breathing and you're no longer manifesting. It's only in the active process. And we go eat. All right, well, I want to take this moment to thank Dan and Shannon and John and Elisa, Corey and Adam and everybody else who made this possible. I've really enjoyed myself, and thank you all for coming out. Well, thank you. Thanks for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. The lecture was a little different. This is the first time I've done a Thelema Coast to Coast where it's pretty much all me. I haven't had any guests or anything like that. So let me know what you all thought of it, what you thought of the content, the ideas, and the various things that were discussed. Very interested in the feedback from the listeners. The closing song is a little different also. In the past, I've been playing kind of electronic and acoustic, alternative rock, those kinds of genres. But I'm going to do a different genre. Today's song brings in death or black metal. This is a very heavy metal death metal band called Behemoth. They're from Poland, and the song is called Decade of Therion. It's from their 1999 album called Satanica. They have a lot of Thelemic influences throughout their albums and songs. They actually have an album that was released in 2000 called Thelema 6.66. Their latest album, released in 2004, has a song called Slaves Shall Serve. And throughout all of their titles, there's lots of Thelemic influence in the lyrics and so forth. And other kinds of occultism too. So it's very interesting. I don't know if you like death metal. Let me know. But here is Behemoth, and thanks for listening to the podcast. Hope you stick around for the next one. Love is the law. Love under will.
faceless. We deny our mountain, tremble morality. We destroy ages, we shine. We destroy ages, we shine. Amo, matos, cacao de moda. Tears of blood in the dusty dead of war. Sign the cases of all the fields of lies. See glory city, but a careful face. With the same song, he will suspense. My rating is strong. So to the blood for the last of the blood. We shall serve by the shadows of madness. Amor, Marcos, Caco, Demona. Demon, this might have died.